The United States Supreme Court has taken a big fat dump on the coffee table again. Well, a few big fat dumps. It seems that since the Dobbs decision last summer when the court reversed Roe versus Wade, which gave 36% abortion opponents what they wanted, while enraging 64% of the population, the Supreme Court has been methodically and deliberately provoking everyone to riot. That hasn't manifested yet. Although one guy brought a can of gasoline and book of matches to the Supreme Court steps, unfortunately he lit himself on fire and left the entirety of the Supreme Court undamaged. Too bad. That guy seemed more useful than all the justices put together. In a string of rulings, the Supreme Court has managed to enrage just about everyone from sea to shining sea. They ruled that Biden's student loan debt forgiveness plan was unconstitutional, which now stacks thousands in student loan debts back onto the shoulders of the American college students who may have already overextended themselves when the debt forgiveness plan was put into place. Then, the Supreme Court ruled that college admissions practices of considering race as a factor was unconstitutional, leading many to conclude that another nail has been pounded in the coffin of affirmative action. Then, on the top of all that, the court decided that a business can have a religious right, and that businesses with religious beliefs that homosexuality is a sin can refuse to provide services for gay weddings. For the first time declaring that religious belief can be an excused cause for discrimination against a protected class. In my own thinking, of all those cases, the third one has the most serious and disturbing implications. In that case, a business owner with a particularly conservative Christian belief wants excused from serving gay weddings because she believes homosexuality is a sin. In that case, the court found that the business owner's religious freedom was more important than gay couples' rights to be free from discrimination. The implications are troubling because this opens the door. What if a white business owner in Alabama or Mississippi has a religious belief that races shouldn't intermingle and refuses to allow black patrons to sit at his lunch counter? Welcome back to 1958. What all of this signals is a new era, and it seems a lot of people are now waking up enraged. The news media is even observing this new thing, although they understand it slightly wrong, I think. They're now talking about how courts have become a kind of undemocratic center of governmental power, issuing rulings that are counter to the beliefs and desires of the vast majority of Americans. It's true that the courts are a center of undemocratic power. What's not true is that this is somehow new. Courts have always been a bulwark that operates without any kind of regard for popular opinion or democratic will. Courts have never cared whether anyone likes what they do. What's new is that the current incarnation of the Supreme Court is pretty brazen about deliberately cherry-picking cases and issuing decisions that resonate only with that 30-something percentile of self-identifying conservatives. What's new is not what they're doing, but how honest they're being about doing it. It's almost as if the Supreme Court has embraced the antipathy. You don't like us? We don't care. Take this work. I can imagine Justice Brett Kavanaugh saying, "I've got all these angry abortion rights people camped out in my yard. Maybe if we take away their student debt relief, they'll have to get jobs to work off their bills and stop peeing in my wife's flower garden." It's like the court sees itself in an inimical conflict with the American people and American culture, and they like it. Their position is pretty clear. We don't care what you think. We don't have to answer to you. The whole foundational myth of popular sovereignty is out the window. Apologists on the far right justify this judicial coup by claiming the court isn't guided by fundamentally undemocratic extremist motives. But that the conservative justices are simply applying a pure and historical method of viewing the Constitution. You'll hear them talk about strict constructionism. Strict constructionism is, as they describe it, a way to interpret what the founding writers of the U.S. Constitution intended. So when they think about any particular issue arising in law, they ask themselves what the original framers intended for the Constitution to be and how the framers expected the Constitution to be applied. By framing this as an intellectual approach, they can sidestep the reality that it's an ideological approach, that when you confine the Constitution to mean only what 18th century white men with muskets imagined it to be, you can transport the culture back to a time of conquest and slavery and the domination of rich white straight men who ran everything, which isn't that different from today. But this strict constructionism is even worse than that. Strict constructionist Supreme Court justices say they're only interpreting the Constitution to mean what the original framers intended. The problem is the original framers never intended for the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution in the first place. If you actually read Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court has a number of powers delegated to it. It has the power to set up and regulate the operation of lower courts. It has jurisdiction to hear appeals. It has trial court jurisdiction in cases involving U.S. citizens in foreign countries. But you know what power the Constitution does not give the Supreme Court? The power to interpret the U.S. Constitution and impose its interpretation on other branches of government or onto the states. It's just not in there. In fact, the first time anyone suggested the Supreme Court had that power was in 1832, long after the constitutional framers had sputtered out. And you know who said the Supreme Court had that power? The Supreme Court. This is the power the court gave to itself. It's not in the Constitution. So if any of those justices were really strict constructionalists, in their next case they'd say, pretty much everything we've done since 1832 is bullshit. But don't hold your breath. They like power. And that's what it's really all about. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the super duper uber mega ultra hyper turbo multi maxi max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can still write Sean at his new old new again address at Sean Swain number A243205 OSP Youngstown 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. You can find his past writings, updates on his case, hear his past audio, find out how to get his books, plus ways to contribute to his legal defense fund at seanswain.org.